started on time, and a very heartfelt thank you and welcome to everyone who's come out today, and welcome to those also signing in on our webcast. Before I introduce today's speaker, Professor Fenster, I'd like to say a few words, if I could, about the Campus Community Committee and our upcoming plans. Some of you may have noticed that for the most part, we suspended our activities in the fall semester, and we're happy to have our community reunited to welcome everyone back who came back to work in December. And I'd like to tell you a little bit of what we've got planned. We have some plans for this February, Professor Fenster's talk today, an upcoming talk which you got a leaflet about. Professor Mizak will be talking about climate change on February 16th. And at the end of this month, we're just about to send out an announcement to invite you all to a birthday party that we're holding on the 28th of February in the Faculty Club. It'll be a lot of fun. It's from 4 to 6. Drop by. You don't have to stay for the full time. We'll have music and dancing, and it's a time for us to just kick back. No speeches, no formal activities, just an opportunity for us to come together as a community. And so I hope you'll all come out to that event. Dr. Fenster plans to take questions at the end of his talk today. If you could just make sure to turn on your microphone by pressing the button and turn it off when you've finished asking your question, and that's so that it can be picked up by our webcast. If I could also ask everyone to turn off your cell phones and turn off your BlackBerries and iPhones, because they're picked up by the webcast and it results in a kind of brrr for everyone listening on the web, and it's a bit distracting. And it's disrespectful to our speaker to have our phones going off also, although I know we're all connected to our desks and anxious to get back and, you know, get back to work, but let's take some time off. I'd like to thank Professor Fenster for coming today and for presenting this very intriguing topic. Professor Fenster not only received his PhD from McGill, but he teaches here at McGill, and he's one of the founding members of the Office for Science and Society. This is a group that does outreach for the university, disseminating information about science to the public. Dr. Fenster is actually well known for his extensive outreach program. He promotes science broadly through public presentations. He appears on television, is heard on the radio, discussing a variety of issues related to science, about science. He's also done some children's television also to promote science. His contributions to teaching and the popularization of science have been recognized by numerous awards. Among them, he won the McNeill Medal for Public Awareness of Science from the Royal Society of Canada in 1992, and he won the Michael Smith Award for the Promotion of Science in Canada from NSERC in 2005. So he's certainly well recognized in the field of science promotion. And his talk today is entitled The Chemistry of Love, and I, like you, I'm dying to hear what he has to say. And he promises this, a lighthearted but scientific look at this topic of interest to anyone who's ever been, is at present, or plans to be in love. And I hope that includes all of us. Dr. Fenster.
Thank you. Well, thanks for the nice introduction, and certainly coming from France, I like to talk about love, practice it from time to time also. In any case, as it was mentioned, I'm with the Office for Science and Society, and I'd like to say a few more words about who we are at the Office for Science and Society. This is something that I started together with Professor Harp and Professor Schwartz many, many years ago, when we were young and full of enthusiasm. Today we are not as young, but still as enthusiastic, and we have all sorts of activities, as it was mentioned, in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and actually, for that matter, all around the world. One thing I'd like to mention is, among the things we do at McGill is that we offer this world of chemistry courses, one on food, one on technology, drugs, and the environment. And what you're going to hear today is, like, actually, we offer this also to the student as part of the lecture on drugs, love being really a drug. And I'd like to point out that these courses, the World of Chemistry courses, that are open to all science and non-science students. And I think it's only at McGill, as far as I know, where we have science courses that both science and non-science students can take at the same time. Sometimes you'll find universities that offer science courses to non-science students, like Chemistry for Poets, for instance. But here we do it, we feel that all can actually benefit. And these courses are the most popular non-compulsory courses at the university. We get approximately, between two sections, 1,000 students per semester. So it's really pleasing to see it being so popular. So let's get started about the chemistry of love. You know, there is this expression when two people get along well, it is said that they have the right chemistry. In French, we say, ils ont des atomes crochus. They have the right linking atoms. So is it possible when you meet that very special person, is it possible that some chemicals are involved? Well, scientists have come to recognize that there are different stages in love. It all starts with attraction, then it's followed by passion, and hopefully if it keeps on going, it continues with attachment. And here are some of the chemicals that have been associated with these different steps. Well, let's get started. Well, we have to get really started low. We have to go with the birds and the bees. Well, actually, it's appropriate that I talk about bees. Actually, more appropriately that I talk about insects. Because actually, when it comes to at least that step of attraction, most of what we know in terms of chemistry of attraction, we know from insects and the way they interact. Insects interact through chemicals known as pheromones. These are chemicals that are usually emitted by the female, and they get their response usually from the male. It is also used as an alert mechanism, but usually it can be, in terms of attraction, used for this particular purpose. As I say, it's usually emitted by the female, and it is used to attract the male. And the next two slides will show you what happens. This is a gypsy moth. This is a female gypsy moth, and she's the one that will release the pheromone. The pheromone will be picked up by the male, and it will be picked up through the antennae of the male. And now you understand why in the male, the antennae are much more developed than in the female. And these pheromones are very, very effective. They're effective in very, very small, very small amount and over great distances. In certain cases, over kilometers distance. And just to give you an example of the effect of the pheromone that is emitted by the gypsy moth, here is a male gypsy moth, pretty happy, but look how happy he gets when he gets a whiff of the pheromone. Now, this chemical has been isolated. His name is Dispalure. And actually, it is used to control insects. The gypsy moth is a major pest, and it eats up, it can destroy trees. And the pheromone is applied to traps to attract the male. It's not so much to kill them all, because there are just too many of them, but it's mostly used to determine the degree of infestation. So the traps are collected, and when you get a maximum amount of male trapped, you know that this is a time to apply the pesticide. There is another way to use this particular pheromone, is to saturate an area with a pheromone. And the poor male flies around, smells a female all over the place, but can't find her, and then eventually dies from exhaustion. Now, the most powerful of the pheromone is the Periplaneta, the one produced by the Periplaneta americana, that's the American cockroach. And this is the chemical, it's known as Periplanon B. And it was very difficult to actually isolate the chemical because, as I said, it's produced, it's very effective in small amount, and it's produced in very, very small amount by the female. And in order to get enough of the chemical to identify it, 75,000 virgin female cockroaches had to be sacrificed. I don't know how they verified the virgin part, but it is certainly of interest. And it is effective at a millionth of a millionth gram. They are doing what you think they're doing there. So very, very powerful. Normally, these pheromones are very selective. They work only for a particular species. But in certain cases, the same pheromone will have an effect on two different species. This is a case of the pheromone that is emitted by the female cotton bollworm and the female tobacco budworm. And in this particular case, unfortunately, the pheromone is similar enough that male from both species will be attracted. That can lead to problems. Because what happened is that because of mismatch genitalia, the male from one species get together with a female of the other species and they get stuck. And they get stuck and it makes really great headlines, as you can see, loving each other to death. Now, sometimes it's not so much of a problem. The Autographa californica has this particular pheromone. It's emitted by the female. And there is another species that has exactly the same pheromone. But I don't think in this particular case it's an issue. Because what is the other species? It would be an interesting sight. In order to identify the pheromone in the female elephant, they had to actually analyze 4,000 liters of urine in order to get enough of the pheromone. Well, going a little bit higher, you know, you have heard of puppy love. Well, certainly it is the same with dogs. We're also dealing with pheromone, and also we're dealing with pheromones that are emitted by the female to attract the male. And this is the reason why male dogs have such a keen sense of smell, because normally they use it to track the female, because this allows them to have a great expectation. Now, from a chemistry point of view, there is something quite fascinating with this pheromone. This is the actual pheromone that is emitted by the female dog to attract the male. In terms of the chemistry, there is one which is very similar, a molecule that is very similar, which is the O2 compound. We call the O2. And what is really fascinating, notice the similarity in structure. Very similar in structure, but it is only the para compound, the compound on the right, that can act actually as the pheromone, not the one on the left. So, for instance, a dog, a male dog, being subjected to the O2 compound, no effect at all. Whereas when it comes to the para compound, yeah, it really very effective, and actually they get very excited in this particular case. Actually, there are chemicals that are used to when the female dog is in heat. All the male dog in the neighborhood gets attracted. So you have chemicals that are used to actually mask the smell of the pheromone. You can see it's the term is actually the correct term, but it's only a masking compound. It doesn't do anything else. It's a masking agent. Now, this chemical that is the pheromone emitted by the female dog to attract the male is also known as methylparaben. You may have heard of the term paraben. There is some concern in terms of cancer and the like, because this particular compound is used as a preservative. It's used as a preservative in cosmetics. And if you look at the cosmetic, you notice that it contains methylparaben. So remember, this is a chemical that normally is emitted by the female dog to attract the male. So now you'll understand why all the male dogs of your neighborhood come to your fragrance or to your cosmetic because of the smell that is given up. Well, we chemists are also interested, believe it or not, in the love life of pigs. Now, I don't know how many of you will recognize what this is. Just a truffle, very good. And you may know that from immemorial time, oh, truffle, these are sort of mushrooms that grow up about 20 centimeter underground, and it's used in Italian and French cuisine. It's very fragrant. It's very nice to have in and omelettes and the like. And since immemorial time, the female pigs has been used to track down to find this mushroom underground. And scientists have been wondering, what is it so special about the this particular truffle, so that the female pig, not so much the male, is attracted to it. Eventually, it was found out that there is a chemical that is emitted by the truffle, a chemical known as androstenol. And this chemical is also emitted, in this particular case, is a male pig's, is also emitted by the male pig in the breath, and it attracts the female. So actually, the female pig, what she looks 20 centimeters underground, she is looking for her boyfriend. And she gets very disappointed when she gets a mushroom instead. Well, this chemical actually has got some application. It is used by farmers to get the female pig in the right mood for artificial insemination. So you can see that actually the farmer spray the androstenol in front of the female pig, because you can see what's going to happen to her in this particular case. But there is more to it. It's really quite fascinating. There is more to it. This chemical, androstenol, is also present in human sweat. So, by the way, the macho guys among you, do not walk by a piggery, because you might be attacked by sex-starved female pigs. So people have been wondering, why is it that we actually produce this chemical in our sweat? Is it to attract the opposite sex? Well, I doubt that. Oh, by the way, you know what this slide is all about? Actually, this is a true picture of the way Procter & Gamble tried, or they don't do it anymore, tested their deodorant. They actually had trained judges, and female because they have more keener sense of smell, they have trained judges that will actually smell and people, a man's armpit. Anyway, this chemical, androstenol, has a musky smell. And it is interesting to note, often fragrance for men, like aftershave, are actually of the musk type. And it would make sense. So this is for essential shave cream. And since I started using it, exciting things have been happening to me. Well, actually, there was a study that was carried out about 15 years ago in Britain. And what they did is that they took the androstenol and they applied it to cinema seats. And what they found that women actually sat preferentially on those seats as compared to any other seat. So maybe there is something in that. And actually, the first scientifically created perfume was based on this idea, was based on androstenol. And actually, I've got some with me. Never leave home without it. And I just wanted to make sure that, or to get an idea of whether or not it is effective. So before you walked in here, I actually applied the pheromone on a one row of seats. Remember, this is supposed to attract the opposite sex. And believe it or not, one, two, three, the third row there. Maybe you could get up so they can truly see. Well, actually, the important thing is to check where the females sit beforehand. Now, supposedly, and again, supposedly, this androstenol attracts females, but actually makes men fearful. And this idea has been used. And this idea has been used in Australia. Study shows that normally in a household, men pay the bill. And by the way, this is true. Men pay the bills. So when they tried this out, they actually applied the androstenol on bills. And what they found is that the bills were paid 20% faster with androstenol on it as compared to none. Well, if you go on the web, you'll see that there are all sorts of ads for pheromone, human pheromone. You see that they got their priority right, you know, like in this thing. And you'll have pheromones that are for men and pheromones that are for women. But it doesn't make much sense because in both cases, you can see in this ad, it is the same pheromone. It would have to be different pheromone. But there is no doubt that our sense have an effect on our mood, on our on even physiological effect. I don't know if you have heard of the woman's dorm syndrome. Studies have indicated that women that live in close quarter after a while will synchronize their menstrual cycle to a certain extent. So there is no doubt that we humans emit certain chemical that can have effect on our behavior and the like. And this is the paper that was written in this matter. Now, a great deal of the work that with respect to smell, the effect of smell on the opposite sex, was carried out at the Monell Research Institute in Philadelphia. And in this particular case, George Preddy, who is really the person in this field, showed that women exposed to male armpit secretion actually were calmer and more relaxed. And this actually a true peer-reviewed study. Here there was another one that it shows that the ingredient in male sweat raises women hormone level. So there is some science behind it. In terms of the pheromone, as far as you know what you find on the net, this is mostly nonsense. But there is something in terms of the science there. Now it is believed that there are two different pheromones that will have different effect on men and women. Androstadienone, you know, they are all, as you can see from the name, they are related. Supposedly, is emitted by the man, to attract the woman. Then, the estratetrainol is emitted by the woman to attract the male. And most of the work has been done on the androstadienone, supposedly, that will attract women to men. And in this particular case, there have been some commercial application to that. Studies have been carried out, blind studies, where the pheromone was applied and women supposedly that smelled it were more prone to identify with the male that produces most of this particular pheromone. And there is a compound on the market called Dial Magnetic, which is supposedly infused with pheromone. It's a gel. It really doesn't make much sense because you use it to wash. So, in fact, it would not make much sense. But I would really suggest that you look at the ad. You go do a Google search and look at the ad for Dial Magnetic. It's really quite clever. Anyway, when I was preparing this lecture, I came a very fascinating market study. It was a market study that had been done by a cosmetic company. And what they first did, they asked a group of women and a group of men, what attracted them in the opposite sex? What was the factor? What did they notice first when they looked at the opposite sex? Well, first they asked men, what do you notice first in a woman when you look at her? Guys? Actually, the eyes. I hope they were honest. They said the eyes. And then they asked a group of women, what do you notice first in a man? Ladies? And I've been walking backward ever since. So, most of what we know truly in terms of attraction is from insect world. There's very little that we can say as far as humans are concerned. But in terms of passion, maybe there is something more in terms of the chemistry. This chemical, which is known as phenylethylamine, has been associated with a feeling of passion, passionate love. Studies carried out at the University of New York have shown that certain people have this need to be in love. They have a high when they are in love. And they determined that these people have high brain level of this chemical, phenylethylamine. How did they determine that? By the breakdown product in the urine. You know, it's not very exciting, but they found that these people's brain produce high amount of phenylethylamine. Now, for those of you who know a little bit of the chemistry, if you look at the structure of phenylethylamine is very similar to the structure of amphetamine, speed. And speed is an upper. And when you are in love, you really have a feeling of high. And supposedly, these people that are addicted to love, that produce phenylethylamine, they want to have this feeling of excitement when you are in love. Now, this is true. The other aspect that is associated with it that you read about in the popular press is a little bit more questionable. That chemical, phenylethylamine, is also present in chocolate. And chocolate is a gift of lovers. So you can assume that on Valentine's Day, when you offer chocolate to your boyfriend or girlfriend, what are you trying to do? You're trying to bring up the levels of phenylethylamine to get the person to be even more in love with you. The other aspect, let's say, unfortunately, you have been dumped by your boyfriend or your girlfriend. What are you going to do? You're going to go for the chocolate because you actually want to have this particular feeling of passion. That feeling of passionate love. Well, there is something maybe there, but it's certainly much more complicated. It is true that people that fall in love easily or that is need to be in love, their brain produces high level of phenylethylamine. It is also true that the phenylethylamine, that chemical, is present in chocolate. But unfortunately, the phenylethylamine that is present in chocolate cannot penetrate through the blood-brain barrier. So actually, it stops at the hips. But there might be some solution. Actually, there is a chemical that is a precursor of phenylethylamine and then can penetrate or can end up as phenylethylamine in the brain, and that chemical is phenylalanine, an amino acid. And actually, it is, rather than eating chocolate or offering chocolate, totally useless, it's much more important to eat or offer food that is rich in phenylalanine. So on Valentine's Day, what you should really offer is much cheaper and certainly more effective. Now, the next stage is attachment. You have been together for a while and you develop a feeling of attachment. And here, this, when it comes to attachment, it seems that in terms of the chemistry, this is the area where most of the chemistry that is associated with this situation is valid for humans. We know a lot as far as humans are concerned. And one of the chemicals that is very much involved is a chemical known as oxytocin. Oxytocin has been called the cuddle chemical. This chemical, when you have high level of this particular chemical, you have a tendency to want to cuddle, to really get close. And actually, this is a chemical that is produced in larger amount by women when they breastfeed. And that's where, you know, you have that great level of attachment. Some studies were also carried with rats and mice, and they found that when they were injected with oxytocin, they have a tendency to get together more, and when it's blocked, they would separate. So really, there is more to it. Now, interestingly enough, there are a great deal of studies that have been carried out with a little rodent called the prairie vole and its close cousin, the mountain vole. Now, the prairie vole has two characteristics. It's friendly, and also it's monogamous, which is very unusual among mammals. Only about 3 to 5% of mammals are monogamous. So the question was, what makes the prairie vole monogamous? This is something that might be of interest. And they found out that some chemicals were involved in this monogamy effect. And the chemical, oxytocin again, another one, dopamine. Dopamine is a feel-good chemicals, but mostly vasopressin. Vasopressin, actually more specifically, vasopressin receptors. It was shown that when these receptors were activated, the Prairie vole, at least from the male, were more monogamous. He was more protective of his mate. When these were deactivated, then he seemed to care less. So it seems that the vasopressin receptor really play a major role. Now, I was telling you that the prairie vole has a close cousin, which is the mountain vole, and like most mammals, this one is polygamous, is very promiscuous, lots of mates. So, of course, scientists have wanted to see what is it in the brain, or genetically, what is the difference genetically between these two species that makes one monogamous, unusual, in mammal, and the other one promiscuous. So is it a question of genes? And scientists at Emory University have shown that, in fact, there is a genetic difference between the prairie vole and the mountain vole, and this could explain why, in fact, the prairie vole, in this particular case, is monogamous and the mountain vole is not. And what has been done is that they found that they actually did some genetic modification on the mountain vole, and it was shown that when this genetic modification was done, the mountain vole tended to become more monogamous, if you want. So there really is something there. And of course, people then have been looking at, is it possible that this applies also to humans? And there, the studies that have been carried out at the Karolinska Institute, in, among other places in Sweden, but also at Johns Hopkins. And they found that there is maybe some effect in terms of vasopressin receptors in humans as well. It's really too early to really generalize, but it's really a quite interesting feature. A lot of the work was done in Sweden. You notice the Swedish name in this case. And today, if you go into the web, you have this outfit that actually will offer a genetic analysis of your mate to find out if he's going to have a tendency to be monogamous or polygamous. It's not cheap, okay? $2,000. Maybe it is worth the cost. But actually, in terms of monogamy, the most monogamous species has to be the clownfish. The clownfish actually, when his mate dies, you know what he does? He changes sexes. He becomes his mate. So this is really interesting. Anyway, there is a difference, of course, between love and sex, although sometimes, often, I should say, one goes to the other. And totally different chemicals are involved there. The chemicals I've been telling you about are chemicals that are involved in emotion and feelings. When it comes to sex, the chemical that is mostly in question is testosterone. And this is both for men and for women. They both increase the sex drive. Interestingly enough, it has been shown when testosterone levels go up, the sex drive or sex, the chemicals that are involved with emotion and feelings tend to go down. So it really seems to indicate that two different stages involved there. Now, certain chemicals have an effect on sex, serotonin. Actually, when that goes down, it lowers the sex drive, it lowers the libido. And this is one of the problems with antidepressant, like Prozac. Antidepressant work by increasing levels of serotonin. And this is one of the common side effects of antidepressant, that the people that are under the antidepressant, their sex drive is lowered. Now, actually, certain food will increase serotonin level. For instance, pasta. And the chemistry is as follows. Pasta is rich in carbohydrate. Actually, it's not only pasta, all the carbohydrate. It increases the absorption by the body of an amino acid, tryptophan, which is a precursor to serotonin. So serotonin goes up, sex drive goes down. And apparently there is a say among Italian, if you want your partner to perform at night, do not serve him pasta. So there might be something there. Now, certain chemical will increase the sex drive, like L-DOPA, which is used for the treatment of Parkinson's disease, increases the sex drive, and you know, it's also sold for this particular purpose. But interestingly enough, there are certain drugs that will increase the sex drive, but actually lower the performance. The urge is there, but the performance will not follow up. And the chemical, of course, that is most associated with this particular effect is alcohol. In Macbeth, it says, it promotes the desire, but takes away the performance. That's the most common one. Now, I have to say a few things about aphrodisiacs. Aphrodisiac, actually, the term is usually associated with sex drive. But an aphrodisiac is not, does not affect the sex drive per se. It mostly in terms of desire, more than, how could I say, no, I shouldn't say that. Let me just go back. It doesn't affect the performance. It affects the desire. So a person that will take an aphrodisiac, the desire will be there, but the performance may not be a follow-up. And many of these aphrodisiacs in history have been developed through what's called the doctrine of signature. And it's based on the fact that if there is an association between a plant, for instance, and some sexual activity or sexual feature, then that should be effective. For instance, the root of the mandrake plant, as you can see, it can look like a man or a woman, and that's for it has been used as an aphrodisiac. Orchids supposedly look like female genitalia, also have been used as aphrodisiac. Some form of cacti, and you can imagine this, of course, brings things to mind, and people will use this with great expectation. As I said, that sex drive and performance are different. The sexual appetite and the performance is different. And when we talk, we tend to talk about aphrodisiac, we tend to refer to performance, which is wrong. But there are ways to improve performance. And these are the so-called impotence drugs. So now, as you're all aware, we have drugs that will improve the impotence. The first drug that were developed for this purpose were drugs that were based on prostaglandin, the class of chemical. It was very effective. It was sold as Cavaget. The only problem there is that it had to be injected directly into the penis. So it was not too popular, even though it was effective. Now, the one that, of course, everybody talks about is Viagra and the similar type of compound. And from a science point of view, it's really quite fascinating how it was discovered and how it actually worked. Viagra, which is known as sildenafil, was initially developed as a heart medicine because it acts as a vasodilator. So it was given to people that had blockage in the artery to dilate the arteries around the heart. But they found out that it was dilating arteries way down. And as a result, they stopped developing it as a heart medicine and developed it as a drug for the treatment of impotence. Now, I just want to go with you through the science behind it, because the science is really truly fascinating. Now, in order for people that suffer from impotence, well, the key is to increase the blood flow, to increase the blood flow in this particular area. And in order to do that is that you have to relax the vascular muscle. You have to relax the vascular muscle, and as a result, the blood will flow in. And there is an enzyme that is involved called cyclic guanosine monophosphate, abbreviated as CMPG, and another one known as phosphodiesterase type 5, known as PDE5. These are the two enzymes that play a major role in erection and also in the way Viagra works. CGMP and PDE5. So what happened is that when the brain sends a signal, as a result, the enzyme CGMP will come out, and this will cause the dilation of the blood vessel in the penis, and the blood will flow in. Now, unfortunately, it flows in and it flows out. Well, unfortunately, what's going to happen is that people that suffer from impotence, the arteries are partially dilated, but the veins, that prevent the blood from flowing out are only partially closed. So these people cannot maintain a full erection. So the key thing is to find a way to increase the dilation of the artery and increase the constriction of the vein. And the way it's done is that what you can do, let me just go here. Here, once the CGMP has been used up, of course, you want to destroy it because you don't want to have a 24-hour erection, so it has to be destroyed. And the way it is destroyed is through the other enzyme, PDF5, okay, which you see on the right. And the way Viagra works is that actually it blocks the PDE5. It blocks the destruction of CGMP. As a result, you get high level of CGMP. The arteries are completely dilated. As a result, they constrict completely the veins. So this is the way it works. The chemistry is really quite fascinating. Now, what is the signal that gets the whole thing started? Well, actually, it's a chemical known as nitric oxide, NO. It's really quite fascinating to think that this whole episode starts with a simple word, NO, nitric oxide. It does work, okay, with Viagra in terms of erectile and the other similar compound. You get 88% improvement in erectile dysfunction, 88%. But actually, with a placebo, you get 39%. So it's really a lot in your mind as well. Now, there are some side effects associated with the use of Viagra. It should not be taken by people that take vasodilator like nitroglycerin, because what's going to happen, you get too much of a dilation, and you're going to get a significant drop in blood pressure, and this can be serious. It can cause headaches, because it will dilate the blood vessel around the skull, and also it can cause visual disturbances because the same enzyme is also involved in vision. And people that have this type of disturbances, visual disturbances, actually they see blue, which is interesting because that's the color of the pill. You see the phosphodiesterase. Now, the animals that are really happy with Viagra is rhinoceros. Because as you may know, the horn of the rhinoceros supposedly is an aphrodisiac, so although it's totally nonsensical. So anyway, to conclude, what are the benefits of sex to start with and then to be in love? Well, studies have shown that people that have frequent sexual episodes have fewer colds, better urinary control, and fewer prostate problems. Interesting laugh, and they also have a better sense of smell. I don't know that correlate, but absolutely this is a study that have been carried out. But what is the major health problem that actually sexual activity could solve? What is a major health problem in North America? Well, or the root of the major health problems in North America, obesity. Obesity is certainly a problem. And then sex there might be of help. A study was carried out in Italy to determine how many calories are expended during sexual episodes. And they found out that when it comes to sex, depending on the fervor, the intensity, between 125 and 300 calories are expended. Interestingly enough, when it comes to kissing, only 6 to 12 calories are expended. So in terms of losing weight, it pays to go all the way. Now, what about, this was sex. What about love? Is love good for our health? Well, studies have shown that when people are in love, there are a lot of good things that happen to them. For instance, they have an improved immune system. They have fewer heart attacks. And actually, they live longer. So in fact, the Beatles were right. Okay. Let me just get this. Well, seems that I cannot get... just hold on. The sound doesn't come out. Okay. That's strange.
You can sing it.
No. I'll let you do that. It's from the, okay. Okay, well, I think we'll be able to do just a sec. So all you need is love. Thank you. But before we go for the question period, anybody here born on February the 14th? Okay, close. April 18th? Come on down! Come on, the other gentleman, come. Oh, it's too, yeah. You see, notice the row she went through? Well, the first thing is you're going to get a big kiss from me because we have the same birthday.
Oh, do we? Happy birthday.
On April of the 18th, we have to think about each other. And you have a door prize. Chocolate.
Oh, thank you very much.
So now I'm open to questions. Totally convinced? No? Yeah?
Do you work with industry at all?
No. But it's really interesting the amount of money that is made on these pheromones. You know, like if you go on the net and look at pheromone, I mean, there is so much done. And also look at this this ad or the on the web. If you look for Dial, the one that is infused with pheromone, it's really quite fascinating the way they actually do it. Now, this pheromone, this as I say, in insects, it's definitely true. In humans, it's much more subtle because, you know, we're much more complicated. It's much more difficult to attach something specifically. Okay, well, so thanks a lot, and enjoy the rest of your day. And
I realize I'd like to thank Professor Fenster very much. It was a thoroughly enjoyable talk and a great way to spend an afternoon. If you could just, there's a questionnaire that is being handed out as you leave today. We'd just like to know what kind of talks you'd like to hear or events that you'd like the Campus Community Committee to sponsor. I forgot to introduce myself earlier. I'm Robin Wiltshire. I'm one of the Campus Community co-chairs. We've got a group of about 75 volunteers who come together as this Campus Community Committee to organize events to bring the McGill community together, and we'd love to hear what you're interested in having us sponsor. So thanks again for coming
more
out today.
More chemistry if they're all like this.
Way to go.
Yeah, we chemists, we're all like this.
Go chemists.